Emo. Emotional music for emotional people. E. M. O.
What is up, friends? Welcome back to another episode here of Classically Emo. Congratulations on making it through another week from last Wednesday to this Wednesday. I don't know, that's a big accomplishment these days, so whatever. Just a life update. I don't know if you guys follow me on Twitter. Presumably you do, because I'm obviously the best person to follow on Twitter. And if you're listening to this podcast, probably because you followed me on Twitter before I told you to follow this podcast. I don't honestly know. But listen, the life update, I've been watching New Girl. I'm almost done with season 3. I've just been binging through this fucking thing. Phenomenal show. I don't think I've ever really tweeted anything bad or ever talked really bad about it, other than once I said it was the new age Office, when everyone kind of revolves their personality around it. You know what I'm saying? Like, think back to like 2 years ago when everyone was like, ah, I like The Office, I'm so quirky, right? That's how I pictured New Girl as, you know? So like, potentially it still has that, but what the fuck ever, it's a great show. Other than that, that has absolutely nothing to do with this, but I just wanted to get that out there because I was literally watching it as I was editing this episode and before I recorded this. So there you go. Another life update. My cat is also now trying to yell into the mic, so I have to push her away. So if you hear a cat scream, she's just dramatic. This just is the way she is. Anyway, we can finally start talking about this week's episode now that I've got all that bullshit out of the way. If you remember back to our first episode, I had James Boss come on, and him and I talked about Sugar Cult's last record, which we both believe is their best record, called Lights Out. And that was our very first episode ever. So, interestingly enough, that opened up the door for Sugar Cult to kind of follow us on Twitter. We talked a little bit back and forth, and I was able to get Sugar Cult guitarist Marco DeSantis on this episode. So him and I have been talking for a few weeks, probably about a month ago, getting this set up, and we actually recorded an episode previously. However, there was a technical difficulty on my end, and he was ever so kind enough to come back on and re-record that episode with me. So that's the little backstory that you wouldn't have known otherwise, but just for full transparency, I'm an idiot sometimes, so that's just how it goes, and here we are. Him and I ended up talking for about 2 hours or so, so I'm going to split this episode up for your guys' sake, other than feel the pressure of having to listen to a two-hour episode, or have no pressure at all listening to about an hour. So here we go. As always, you're going to hear a little bit of an ad, then him and I are going to jump right into it, talk a little bit about everything about Sugar Cult. For part one, we kind of talk about the beginnings up through that Start Static era, and then part two, we kind of pick up after that, and you'll hear a little bit more about that as we kind of go through it. So no spoilers here, and in the next minute or so, Marco will take it away, and then let me know what you guys think, and we'll see you next week as always. All right, Marco, I appreciate you coming on here with me. If people don't know this, but we'll tell them anyway, this is our second time recording this just for fun, after I had some technical difficulties on my end. So, Marco, I appreciate you coming back on and doing this with me again.
All right, man. Well, you know, I always put out on the second date. So, for your listeners, you're going to get a way better interview. You're going to get a way spicier Sugar Cult interview than last time. So.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I'm sure they'll love it. And I'm happy to have you back here. We're appreciating doing it on a Zoom this time so I can see you, which is always a plus.
Yes. And to those of you who are just listening, let me just describe myself.
Yes, please do.
You know, I'm even sexier than I was in our memory video. So,
hey,
yeah.
That's right. Like I can vouch for that.
It gets better with age.
That's right. That's right. I appreciate it. That's actually very true. So, Marco, I wanted to talk a bit about obviously everything. I know, you know, we kind of first connected after James and I did the Lights Out episode. And so we want to talk about that, but obviously kind of like we did last time, a little bit more than that. So, I know last time you had told me that obviously you joined the band pretty much at the beginning, after you met Tim at a Super Drag concert, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the band officially started in 1999, probably actually in the, I don't know when this is going to air, but right now it's the spring.
Yeah.
So it was literally like exactly this time of the year.
Yeah.
but way back in 1999. So yeah. We're probably like the last band that formed at the end of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And then we put out our first record, Start Static, at the very beginning of the 21st century. So it's kind of a fun, like, turn of the century, turn of the millennium story. There's probably only a handful of bands that can say that, you know, like we're in a small little generation of bands. It's just like, you know, we caught the tail end of, you know, we got early contact high from the 80s culture. We kind of came of age as like music fans and musicians in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the 90s, we had, you know, formed our own band and just were kind of scrappy and making it happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the beginning of this century, we were off to the races, dude. I mean, we literally made, it's funny about the spring. because in my birthdays, I'm May 3rd is my birthday. So I'm not one of those like woo-woo California people that everyone's listening right now, like rolling their eyes like, oh shit, what do we got ourselves into?
Yeah.
But you know, we are from Southern California. So like, I will just give you a disclaimer. If you want to play like a drinking game and take a sip of your drink every time I say rad or dude or like or awesome, then you might as well just get
this. This is the perfect podcast to get drunk to with that drinking
game. You will
game.
Get wasted by the end of this thing. But yeah, so we are a band from Southern California. And I will say, like, it's kind of an interesting thing because, like, I joined the band. I got a call from Tim. I remember I was on a snowboarding trip. And this is how long ago this was, kids. We didn't have iPhones, you know, back then.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
You had to literally have, like, I mean, we were advanced past this, like, we thought we were really modern because you didn't have to have an answering machine with a tape in it. You could have what was called voicemail, and it was kind of a digital service where you could literally, like, someone would call your house, not get you, but leave a message. And then wherever you were in the world, you could call this number and, like, check your messages. So that's, like, pretty much, that's how you got laid. That's how you formed bands. That's how you found people that were lost when you were on tour. And, you know, like, that's just how it worked. It's really funny too, because like your life revolved around finding like access to a phone, like maybe in the promoter's office where you can make a long distance phone call, or maybe at work where you could be like, you know, #9 and it would open up the line and you could make a long distance call and try and book a show. Long distance calls used to actually be like a thing that you had to deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to go on a tangent already. We haven't started, but just real quick.
That's perfect.
I played, if you notice my Atari's gold record back there. Well, I played in an early version of the Ataris before Sugar Cult.
Yeah.
So actually I was, I sort of identified myself. I started on guitar when I was a kid, but then I switched to bass because my friends had a band and they were really good guitar players. And I basically wanted to be in their band so I could play with them. I sort of have like like instinctively, no one told me this, and you're a little kid, you don't know what you're doing, but sort of instinctively, I had this idea where I was like, I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. If they say if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. You know, I don't want to be the guy, like I had this neighborhood band and I was the guy like teaching everybody how to play their instruments. So, and I was writing all the songs so we could have a band. Yeah. And like these other kids in town had like, could play really well. Like we were just typical kids who could barely handle it.
Yeah.
And then the other kids in town that were like maybe a year or two older than us could actually play. And they asked me, at least they had the decency to like ask me a question. Basically, like, imagine if someone came up to you and said, hey, is it cool if I date your girlfriend? Like, yeah, that's cool, dude.
Yeah, so sounds perfect.
Asked
yeah.
me if they could have my bass player that I had taught how to play bass so that I could have a bass player. And I basically said to them, I was like, no, you can't have my bass player. You can have me, and I'll switch to bass. And they're like, but I thought you were a guitar player. I was like, I don't care. I just want to play music. I'm not that good. So like, you know, fuck it. I'll play bass so I can play with you guys. And I got so much better as a musician by being the like kid who was like, you know, trying to keep up with the big kids who were better. You know, it's like, if you join the soccer team that you're not qualified for, you're going to get good because you don't want everyone to like looking at you just all, dude, what's up? You got another own goal. Like, you don't want to be the one who like is the reason they lose the game.
So, yeah,
like,
of course.
Like, these guys were like, dude, you better get your shit together. You know, I don't care if your mommy says you can't play a show on a weeknight. Like, we will get someone else so fast you won't even know what hit you. And I was like, said, okay, I'll do it. And my mom was like, okay, but you have to have straight A's and never miss school. So I literally like sat in the front. I looked just like this when I was a kid. I still, you know, and I was like the weirdo looking kid with like purple hair sitting in the front row, mostly because I was too vain to wear glasses because I had bad eyesight. Yeah. I've since had LASIK, which is kind of crazy. They like literally cut your eyes open.
Yeah. But you know, terrifying procedure. Yeah.
It's anyway, like I was too vain to wear glasses and I was too, I was too obsessed with like music to like let something as sort of inconsequential as high school get in the way of my rock and roll dreams. So I was
of course.
I mean, honestly, anyone listening to this, you know the deal. Like unless you have like a learning disability or something, like, school is pretty easy if you don't like, if you actually just pay attention and you just try like a little bit. It's not hard at all, actually. Like it's hard if you have like something like if you, you know, if you have, like I said, like a learning disability or something, but like, you don't have to be a genius to get through high school and, and do fine. You just have to be able to like have, in my case, I just needed something that I cared about. And I cared about being in a band and my parents were pretty strict and they were like, you can't do this, especially on school nights if you don't, if it affects your school.
Yeah.
So I was like asking, raising my hand and asking questions and going to the teacher after class and being like, let me make sure I understand this geometry thing. And like, in a way that was like, it sounds so weird, but like music kind of helped me do well in school.
Yeah.
Whereas you would think like other kids that played music, they were like the ones who like dropped out of high school or like would cut class and go do drugs. For me, I was like, I'm staying like not fucking with any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm getting good. I'm going to basically be a nerd, you know, I'm going to be a nerd with like, you know, trapped in a leather jacket and purple hair, you know, and weird looking shoes. So, and that was my thing. And honestly, like once you figure out that, like things that everybody else seems to say are really hard aren't really that hard if you actually apply yourself. This is an incredible, like empowering thing that happens where like suddenly you just kind of, I mean, and again, I was just a kid. I didn't realize this shit like, like consciously, but like now I can look back and go, oh, that's what I was coming up with. I was intuitively coming up with it where I was like basically teaching myself the lesson that if you have something you want and you make it your goal and then you like figure out the steps to go after it, then obstacles are kind of like easy.
Yeah.
Getting good grades, not that hard. If it's between like, well, do you want to get good? If you want to go hot to get in a car with your friends and drive down to LA, we grew up in Santa Barbara, drive all the way down 2 hours away to LA to play a show on a Wednesday night and like, Or do you want to just fuck off in high school and just, you know, have all, you know. And so I had that thing and literally, dude, I've like, as a kid, as like a 10th grader, I'm like backstage at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood, which is 100 miles away from my house with like, you know, crazy looking hair and like probably a beer in my hand that they gave me.
Let's be honest.
Like, well, you're a band and you're playing here, like, and like a highlighter and a fucking textbook. And I'm like sitting there like doing my, someone has a picture of me doing that. I'm like doing my homework backstage with a bunch of girls around and like guys in bands. Yeah. And it was just like, I mean, I must've looked like the biggest fucking tool, but I had this like mission where I was like, nothing's gonna stop me, especially something I can actually control. Like there's enough things that are gonna stop you in life that you have no control over, like just bad timing, bad luck, you know, God forbid some tragedy happens or whatever it is. But like, I was like, at least I'm going to do my part to make sure I get a chance to have a music career. And honestly, dude, I'm going to spare you guys the long drawn out story because I know this is about Sugar Cult. It's not just about me, but I had so many like moments where like, okay, I did everything. I did everything I needed to do. And then I got something as good as it was going to get. And then something else came along and sabotaged it.
Yeah.
Another thing came along and I had another band. So by the time I got to like Sugar Cult, I had already been playing in bands since I was 14 years old and like gigging, playing shows. So I was kind of a combination of someone who started really early, but then also was kind of a late bloomer. I had all these other things that were like short-lived bands, almost like relationships. Like you have a relationship that you think is the one and then it doesn't work out. And then another one you think is the one and then whatever, you know, and then like a normal person would go, okay, well, I guess, you know, that's not for me. I guess I'm giving up on love, and like write a bunch of songs. And that's where you get like the Ataris, you know, yeah. Chris Rowe, like he's sworn 1,000 times. He even has a song called "The Last Song I Will Ever Write About a Girl." Like literally that's the title of the song. And he can't stop. He's such a hopeless romantic. He's been married like 5 times. And I mean, the guy's like, you know, but he's one of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. Cause he's so passionate and like committed to his work. He's someone you should do a podcast interview.
Yeah. With.
His story is way more interesting than that. But I do get to play a tiny role in one chapter of the Atari story, and that has a lot to do with what leads to Sugar Cult.
Yeah.
So you've got this small town, Santa Barbara, but a lot of bands start to come from our town in a really weird, like, you've got like a group of like 30 kids that are interested in music, and we all start playing in shitty little bands and then like sharing bass amps and sharing practice spaces and sharing girlfriends and sharing, you know, clothes. I mean, it's like, this little, we're a small little beach town. Look up Santa Barbara. It's a lot of people like to go there on vacation. But when you grow up there, Sugar Cult, we actually have a song about this called Stuck in America, where like no matter where you are, when you're young, you're just unsatisfied.
Yeah.
And you want something more.
Yeah.
It's not enough. It's like, people are like, Santa Barbara, damn, that's where I go on vacation. We're like, yeah, dude, it's fucking boring. And by the way, if you think it's all about going to the beach, you literally have to drive half an hour south or half an hour north to get any waves that you can actually surf. So until you're 16 and can drive, you basically are like at the mercy of like people's parents driving.
Yeah.
So it's like you end up just forming neighborhood bands because it's kind of just something we did. You'd like skateboard and then you'd play music and then you'd hang out and then you'd play music, just something to do. And that was just kind of our lifestyle. There was really no thought process as far as like we're going to make it big one day or we're going to be like professionals. It was just we're lucky in our town. That was just the culture. If you were young and you were kind of an outsider, you know, you didn't play like organized sports or there was kind of like the path was like you either play music or you skateboard or both.
Yeah.
And most of us did both, but like certain people were just like, okay, like in my case, I hated getting hurt and I kind of sucked at skateboarding, but I kind of was better than most of my friends when I first started at music. So I just kind of went, well, instead of being like the worst skater in the pack, I'll be the best guitar player in the pack.
Yeah.
And then I met a bunch of people like, they were way better than me on guitar. So I was like, okay, well now I fucking suck all around. So now what? But you know, it's just, you know, it's kind of like you flunk upwards. You just get, like I said, don't lock yourself out of the room with the good people, go into that room and like adapt. Humans are capable of adapting. So I'm sorry, I'll get back on track. Cause it's a little bit of a backstory that honestly, there's a million interviews with Sugar Cult and there's a million things you can read, but you're not going to know this. And this is important. The backstory is kind of important, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this town, it's a pretty small town, and this music scene, it's pretty vibrant. Like certain bands actually start to make it. And we're like, we have these like kind of older brothers, not literally our brothers, but like older bands that came like, you know, that we sort of can look to and go, I mean, if anything, it gives you, this is kind of a cringy music industry business term, but it gives you proof of concept.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that like, hey, another band from here, like Lagwagon or Toad the Wet Sprocket or Dishwalla or the Mad Caddies, you know, these other bands that came from our town, or the first one was this band RKL that most people don't know about, but they were this amazing band, like 80s punk band that influenced like NOFX and Lagwagon and all those bands. But like these bands came from here and now that people know about them all over the world.
Yeah.
And that gives you like, that's really encouraging. Cause suddenly you just go, wait a minute, we're not limited to like what we can see in this little box in our little village here. Like the height of our success is not, we got to play a club on State Street.
Yeah.
Like we now know that like, if we don't miss class and get straight A's, you know, if we do what we can control, if we at least work on take ourselves seriously and actually practice and actually like try to be good at what we do, and be like goal oriented and don't just kind of like be like, fuck it, dude, being in a band, just do some party with your bros. Like if we actually take this like somewhat seriously and treat it a little bit like a business, then the possibility exists. And that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
You know, like well, what else can you do in life? You can't control how shit works, but you know, you can control how you set yourself up so the possibility will work.
Yeah. Okay?
So it's like, you can't force love. You can't go out and say, I'm going to get laid tonight, but you can, like, you know, make your bed, maybe have some protection nearby.
Put on the best cologne, man. Yeah.
Maybe brush your teeth. Maybe get in shape, and then maybe when you're out there, and maybe try to be a good version of yourself, then maybe when you're out there, you might attract somebody. And if you do, you're going to be ready for them when they come back to your pad, right? Which never worked for me, because when I was when I was coming up as a musician, I lived at my parents' house in my early 20s, because I was dude, I don't want to fucking be burdened by like grown-up expenses.
Mm-hmm.
That's gonna, again, it's one singular vision. I am going to be successful in music. So I was like, I don't care about having a cool apartment and a flat screen TV and playing grown-up just so, like, you know, I can get some chicks. I would rather live, like, you know, kind of keep my overhead low, live at home, you know, work a part-time job instead of a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And then put all my effort into the band, and then you'll get plenty of chicks. Right. You know, if it works out.
Sure. Fine. Yeah.
But anyway, so that was kind of the attitude. And it was like, you know, it was just one of those things where it was like, you know, like I said about love, you can't force it. You can be prepared for it. You can try to attract it, but you can't go out and force it. You can't. And people who do usually end up with somebody that they weren't supposed to be with.
Sure.
Or they end up, you know, settling for something that's not really, you know, something that they just, you know, so, or you're just completely going, like, it's like a total gamble. So you actually can, without sounding too, like I said, without sounding too like woo woo and self-helpy, like, but if anybody's listening to this that cares about this kind of stuff at all, like that maybe is in a band and wants to try to do it, you actually can kind of put this out there and actually follow through with it. There's a lot of luck and dumb luck and timing and just aligning of the stars involved, but there actually is a lot of actual practical actionable shit you can do.
Yeah.
You know, you also have to have you gotta be a little bit crazy too. Cause if you're too practical, then you're fucked.
Yeah.
Because there's no way. Like if Sugar Cult, we were like four guys that were like at any given time, like, our crazy factor was pretty up there. And there was probably never a time where all four of us were like, at least one of us was like neurotically fucking obsessed with success.
Sure.
At any given time. Oftentimes it was more than one of us. And that's probably what got us to where we got in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
We were literally a band for about 2 years from the time we started playing gigs and kind of sucked to when we got our shit together, maybe about a year in, and then started making some local waves and getting attention locally, and then playing some shows down in LA and having people kind of like us. And then we started having some labels get attracted to us.
Yeah.
And then we actually got signed I signed a record deal February 1st of 2001. And then that spring we went into the studio just about like probably around now, around April, we went into the studio because I remember Joey Ramone died from the Ramones, and it was Easter. We had an Easter egg hunt in the recording studio, and it was my birthday. So sometime in the spring of 2001 is when we recorded Start Static. We made it at the studio called Rumbo that's not there anymore, but it was this really cool studio that was like nautical themed. Like all the windows were like little like boats, like, you know, the little circular windows on old like yachts and stuff. There was a band like in the 70s, I think. They were like sort of a yacht rock band called Captain and Tennille.
Interesting.
I don't know. They were before my time even. But they were literally, it was like a man and a woman. I think they were husband and wife. It was like the pre-White Stripes, like husband and wife that formed a band. I think they probably got a record deal because of the Carpenters, like where you have like this guy that sings and this girl that plays drums and sings. I don't know what the deal was, but they were called Captain and Tennille. They made a bunch of money. They had some hits. So then they decided to open a studio. And so like the whole place was like boat themed, which was really weird. And then there was this weird like vibe where like Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses was recorded there.
Nice.
The reason why, it turns out the reason why their label put them there was because it was like a half an hour away from Hollywood. So you had to actually drive there. And they thought the guys in Guns N' Roses were so crazy. Like they were all a bunch of like drug addicts and stuff. They thought it would be safe. Like they would reduce the chances of the guys in the band like being bored in the studio and like going out and like getting into trouble. Yeah. So they specifically chose that studio because it was like inconvenient to get away from and get to get to. So Guns N' Roses made Appetite there. No Doubt made Tragic Kingdom there, which was like the big one, right? With like Just a Girl and everything. And then like, what else? Like Quiet Riot had done Metal Health, like this thing, like the, basically the record that started 80s metal.
Yeah.
And there was one other like, Smashing Pumpkins did Siamese Dream there, which was like, right? So we're just like, dude, we're in this fucking boat looking studio and like, in the walls are just platinum records of all these legendary records that had been made there. And it was a vibe, dude, for to be a brand new band who just got signed and were like in a studio, in a real studio for the first time ever. And just feel like, dude, this is such a trip. Like bands have walked into this studio as unknown bands like Guns N' Roses, unknown local bands, and walked out with a record that ended up changing their lives.
Yeah.
So no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure at all. Yeah.
So like, totally here we go. Like, let's try to make our first record.
Yeah.
And so that's how we made Start Static. And that was like in this, that was the spring of 2001. And then the summer of 2001, we got the Warped Tour.
Mm-hmm.
And that left, I remember we drove out to Phoenix, started June 20th, 2001, got to Phoenix, jumped on the Warped Tour. We were supposed to play for 11 days. And then like, someone tipped us off. They're like, dude, I heard if you like on the Warped Tour, it's like kind of like a pirate vibe. Like it's real ramshackle throw and go. Like every day there's a different set. Like they don't tell you when you're going to play until the morning of. So it kind of keeps the rock star egos in check. So like if even if you're like rancid, you might be playing at like 8 p.m. one day, but then you might be playing at 2 p.m. the next day.
Yeah.
It also keeps their philosophy was that way fans are going to come for the whole day.
Yeah.
So like, we were on this thing and they tipped us off. They're like, if you guys are cool and you don't act like a bunch of, you know, prima donnas and you're just cool and you're cooperative. And if people seem to like you, they'll probably let you stay on the whole show. Just ask them. They'll let you stay on the whole tour. And we're like, reals? So we were just total model citizens. We're like in the lunch line with our trays, just like, thank you. Oh, yes. The Bolognese, it was lovely today. Did you make that yourself? You know, we were just like the total like star students, just trying to be cool, watching the other bands play. Just, we worked our ass off that year. You know, we were constantly out there hustling, passing out sample CDs and stickers. Yeah. And we tried to meet every single kid at the Warped Tour in every city. Like, and we probably almost did. Like, I told the guys in the band, I was like, here we go again. No cutting class. And we're getting A's and B's. Unless there's something wrong with us. Like if you have a fever, go sleep.
Yeah.
If you are about to get laid, then have fun. But if not, we're working. We're at work, not just when we're on stage for 20 minutes.
Sure.
This is our handshake with the world. Like we are going to be out there and we literally, people who are listening to this, you might've been at that Warped Tour. You would remember it was like me and Tim, our singer, and Aaron, our bass player. And then at the time, our drummer, Ben, every day, just armed with like a box of like three song CD samplers and these stickers that we had gotten our label to make for us. And we were just like handing them out to kids and not just like passing out to people and walking by, like going up and going, hey, what's up you guys? What's your name?
Yeah.
Cool. Right on. So we're in this band from California called Sugar Cult. You should check us out. Like, do you like these? What kind of bands are you like? Oh, you probably won't like us. Never mind. I mean, if you want to check it out, check it out. But if you like it, do me a favor, like burn this thing for like everybody, you know, okay. Yeah. You don't know anybody fucking Minneapolis, Orlando, Austin, New York, wherever we went that wasn't California, we were like, this, you guys got to be our person. We were trying to just like create like an army of like Sugar Cult reps, you know?
Yeah.
And like people, kids, I mean, I know this sounds so cheesy, but like the fans and the kids at the Warped Tour were like, they deserve our success is because of them.
Yeah.
Because our label, we weren't on a big label. We were on a label that really had no idea what they were doing. They had money, which was great. They had a staff, they had distribution, but they had no idea how to reach our people.
Yeah.
And so we didn't even know who we were. We didn't even know who we were. We didn't start out and say, hey guys, want to form a pop punk band? We'd never, you know, like when we were starting out, dude, it was 99. So when someone said emo, they didn't mean My Chemical Romance and Fallout Boy. They meant Mineral and Jeff to Brazil and, you know, like Sunny Day Real Estate and like maybe Jimmy Eat World, who's just like a kind of a new band back then.
Right.
You know, so it's, and then people start calling you emo a couple of years later. You're like, okay, cool. Just, is that a good thing? Are you calling, is that an insult or is that a compliment? They're like, no, I love it. They're like, okay, cool. Yeah, call me that. And then they're like, oh, yeah. I don't know, man. All those pop punk bands, you know, Blink 182, Newfound Glory, Simple Plan, Sum 41, Sugar Cult, Good Charlotte, you know, all that stuff. And you're like, wait, what? Like, are you telling us that we sound like those bands? And we, like, I'm honestly, not that, I mean, we became friends with all those bands. We toured with all those bands. But at the time, we had no idea that that's what we, that that's where we belonged.
Yeah.
We kind of, like I said, we come from a small town and we were just like, I had played in the Ataris, which I didn't really finish telling you that story. I had played in the Ataris for a minute as a bass player when their singer first moved to California. He was like literally 19 years old, straight off the, you know, with nothing but like what he could pack in his backpack and his guitar. And he just came to town and he's like, I got some tour dates booked. I need a bass player. Someone told me you're cool. And I was like, fuck it. What, tour? That's all you got to say. Let's go. And tour did not mean like anything fancy. It was like, he had this broken down old van and we would just go play shows in California, like opening. We're like the opening band for MXPX or something like that. Right. And so I got a little bit of experience from that. But the main experience I got from the Ataris at the time, because this was like right when their first record came out and I didn't play on it. He had already made the record himself. And then he was trying to put together a band to tour. I got experience because I was like, oh, this is what bands do. They play shows, they meet fans, and then they sell t-shirts, and then they hope to make enough money to find a place to sleep, and then they wake up the next day and do it again. So I was kind of learning it in a very like, because up until then, I played some shows out of town, but mostly just drive to LA, play a show, come back to Santa Barbara. Maybe drive up to San Francisco, play a show, come back to Santa Barbara like the next day. But I never really like toured. And then once I started in the Ataris, we do these like week-long, 10-day tours, like opening for bands that were like a little bit more like somewhat professional. And you'd sort of like, again, you learn so much from observing and you'd watch how they worked a crowd. You'd watch how they behaved. You'd watch how they loaded their gear, what kind of gear they played, how they packed their van. Like just, it's like, it's fucking college. You're learning. Yeah. You're like, I'm like taking it all in, just going, okay, I've been obsessed with this shit since I was 14. And now I'm learning how it works when you put it on wheels and take it on the road. And I just, you know, I did that in a couple other bands. I kind of became this like hired gun, this little phase of my life where I was sort of this hired gun where I played the Ataris for a little while, played with this other band for a little while. And then I just kind of got really dissatisfied because I felt like I was always like the stepmom. Like I was always like jumping on someone else's already like, here's our family. This is how we've done things for years. Oh, and you're the new guy. So come on and learn these songs. And then I'd be like signing an autograph and feeling kind of like, this isn't really like, this isn't me. Like I didn't have anything to do with the reason this is successful. Even it wasn't successful, but it was like, you know, low level punk bands.
Yeah.
And I was kind of playing them and I was like, this has been awesome, but I got to figure something else out.
Yeah.
And I honestly, it's what the weirdest thing, dude, full like day is darkest before the dawn situation is like, I was literally about to like give up playing music.
Yeah.
I was still pretty young, but like since I'd been playing since I was 14, it felt like it'd been like a lifetime already. Yeah. And I felt like, God, I just can't catch a break. I do everything right. I'm getting A's and B's. I'm not cutting class. I'm doing this. I'm doing everything in my power. And then I realized I was like, fuck, maybe it's like the people I'm in a band with. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't find other people that care as much as I do, or I just not, it's just not the right mix, you know. And I got to this point where I was like, I think I'm done. I think I'll just try doing something else now. And I literally right then I met Tim, you know, and he and I like hit it off where I was just like, dude, who are you? Like, and I heard his songs and I was like, God, you're such a good songwriter. And he's just like, so like charismatic, you know, you just see him and you're like, this guy's a star. He's, you know, no one in this room realizes it. No one's even in this room, but like, you could tell he's just like emanating this like vibe. It sounds so silly to say, but like something about him where you're just like, there's something about this guy that's different than other people that I've played music with. And he was kind of new to my town. He had moved to Santa Barbara to go to college. Mm-hmm. And then he had been hooked up with our bass player, Aaron, and our drummer, Ben. And they sort of started this band. They were kind of this ramshackle band. Ben had like long since given up playing music, but he was aspiring to be an engineer. So he was like, had his own little home studio, and he was like trying to book clients. And I think Tim hired him to record his like new songs he had been writing. Cause Tim was kind of new to writing songs. Tim actually mm-hmm. started out on drums, but he was like, you know, he was the kid, I think I told you this last time, where he yeah. was the kid who would walk around the community college with like an acoustic guitar and cruise up to chicks and be like, "Hey, want me to play you a song?" And they'd yeah. be like, okay, you know, and he'd be like, and he sings the song, but he just had no shame. Like he's had no problem. Just, you know, you kind of can't hate him. Like yeah. anyone else who would do that, yeah. people would be like, "Dude, you're such a cornball." But for some reason with him, you're like, that's actually kind of sweet, you know? Yeah. And then like, he was really good. Like even yeah. when he first started writing songs, he just had this like natural ability to just like instinct to write kind of like catchy songs. And when I met him, they sort of had this band. And like I said, Ben was recording people. So he recorded Tim, and Tim, I think, bit off more than he could chew and didn't realize he was going to like run out of money. You know, he's like broke dude. It was like yeah. freshman year. Give you my drum set, because I don't play drums anymore. How about if I give you my drum kit in exchange for some studio time? So he like gave Ben a drum kit, and Ben had like didn't have a drum kit at the time. So he's like, "Oh, actually that'd be cool, because I would love to have a kit in my studio, and plus I'm a drummer." And he's like, "Oh, cool. Well, you want to play some drums on these songs?" So they started like making up these songs, and Ben sort of fell back into playing drums. Mm-hmm. And like the band sort of formed really like, or like Aaron was just like the kid who sat next to Tim in some like class at City College, and like Tim would like look over and copy his answers from Aaron, because Aaron was really smart. Tim was not much of a school guy, yeah. but like Aaron was kind of the guy that like would let Tim copy his answers, you know, like sort of push the test over and just be like, "Here, dude, check on my answers." And then so he ended up getting a gig as the bass player. Like I said, there was no pretense. There was no like, "Hey, you want to form a band that sounds like this?"
Yeah.
Like total oddballs. Like Ben, I don't even know what's to this day, I don't even know what kind of music Ben really likes.
Yeah.
Tim was all about like, he was raised on like Green Day, Nirvana, yeah. Foo Fighters, you know, all the 90s shit, like, you know, it was on the radio, but he was mm-hmm. basically raised on radio. Like he didn't have like, I was kind of a nerdy like record collector.
Yeah.
And Tim literally had like 10 CDs and they were all like greatest hits albums. You sure. know? Like, he was like, "I have no time for anything that's not a fucking hit."
Yeah.
So, and I'm like the opposite. I never listened to the radio ever growing up. And I liked really like outsider, weird underground music. And then, so like somehow when we met, it was kind of this, like, we kind of made up for each other. Like
yeah.
he was like, "Dude, hit songs are awesome." And I was like, "Well, dude, bands that have a cool vibe are awesome." And we sort of met in the middle, and we mm-hmm. kind of hit it off as friends and just as music nerds, like just yeah. talking things we liked about certain bands, like the way they looked, the way they dressed, the way their guitars were, like very shallow kind of long conversations where we'd yeah. be like, "Dude, isn't it lame how bands that like," we would talk mostly about shit we hated, you know? Like, have you ever seen that painting you see like around where it says like, "I like you because we both hate the same stuff"?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that kind of a relationship at first, where me and Tim, we probably bonded more over how our worldview of aesthetics of like what we both hated and thought was lame. And then like somewhere in there was like things that like were in common, where like, I like this and you like this, we hate this. And we found this sort of weird vibe where we like kind of were educating each other too. Like he would sort of explain to me why these songs were, you know, we were bond on shit we were trying to learn. And I was kind of like fed up with like I'd played with the Ataris, but I was fed up with the sort of punk scene.
Yeah.
Cause I felt like at that time in the late 90s, it had just become such a, like, everybody and their grandma had like a band like that. And, and I was like, this is cool. Cause Tim seems to be like interested in like old music too, like learning about like the Cars and Elvis Costello and like Cheap Trick. And I liked a lot of that kind of stuff too. Like I was like the nerdy guy who would like go to used record stores. And like, we sort of had this concept where like, dude, what we should do is kind of make our band, like if we could be in a band together sometime, because again, I was in the band. We were just, hey, maybe we'll form a band one day, or maybe like, we'd be like, wouldn't it be cool if there was a band that was like modern rock, like bands like the, at the time, like bands like Foo Fighters and Weezer and you know, Green Day and I don't know who else was on the radio back then, probably like Everclear and some shit, you know, like that, but also like kind of like dumpster dived in the past and found like cool shit from like those British bands, like the Buzzcocks and the Clash and like, Elvis Costello and, you know, a lot of the stuff from like the '80s, like the Knack and the Romantics and like Cheap Trick and like sort of these cool bands you heard growing. You'd like, maybe like were like the bands of like bygone generations.
Yeah.
There was something kind of cool about them, like Blondie or, you know, stuff like that, where you're like, that's, I like the way they look. I like the way they're like art, their imagery, their aesthetic, and like some ideas from their sound, but I just definitely don't want to be like a retro band.
Yeah.
You definitely want to be modern. And one day it was like, we just had this weird thing where it was like, God damn, I wish I would have found you like a few months ago because I already have a bass player. you know? Right. And I was like, I know, dude, fuck. Well, you know, it's a weird thing. Like, again, it's like if you met someone like that was in, like you meet some girl and she's already in a relationship, but you hit it off with her so hard that you're like, fuck, well, let me know if it ever doesn't work out. You know, like, you're like, I kind of wish I never would have met you, because now I'm like, now anyone else I meet, I'm going to compare them to you and be like, well, that person's cool, but they're nowhere near as cool as that. You know, of course you can't go to your friend's girlfriend or like someone else's girlfriend and be like, hey, come date me. And I sort of had like this weird feeling with Tim where I was like, I felt like I was like musically like being a home wrecker, where I was like, well, I don't want to go there. And like, I don't want to like try and steal Aaron's gig, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't know Aaron, so I didn't have an emotional connection to him. I was like, why are you got that guy playing bass? Come on, what's up? Like, and then like literally in May, then I know I went around the block instead of going.
No, it's all good.
In May of 99, he calls me up. I was on a snowboarding trip. I check my messages. No, my voicemail, sorry. And it's like, hey, what's up, man? It's Tim. Just wondering, like, if you'd ever, like, think you could ever play guitar. You know, because, like, I'm kind of like, we've been playing a couple things and, as a three-piece, and I feel like, you know, we made some demos, and they have guitar parts on them, but I can't, like, you know, you can't, like, tap your head and rub, you know, it's like, it's kind of a, you know, I don't think I have the coordination to like play a guitar part while I'm also singing. So like, I kind of want to, I think we should be a four piece for this band that he's kind of forming. And I was like, he actually originally said, could you play some guitar and play some keyboards? And I like, was like, okay, I have zero experience on keyboards. I mean, you know, every musician can play like a, you know, whatever, like maybe a C major chord, but like, I don't have like technique or anything.
Yeah.
And then guitar, you know, unbeknownst to him, I started on guitar. So I had some facilities on guitar, but honestly, like I played in like a shitty punk band when I was like 14. So like I could play like maybe bar chords, but I'd never like had a pedal board or played like guitar parts before, like barely played leads, you know, other than like Chuck Berry, just like, you know? So like he asked me and he had this thing, because like I guess the drummer had a friend who really wanted to play guitar and he really wanted him in the band, but he was like a metal shredder.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim was like terrified of that happening because he was like, oh my God, if we get that guy, we're like, Tim is like, he's like, cannot deal with shredding or metal or even the blues, you know? and he was like, I'm so afraid if I get some guy who just like overplays in all of our songs.
Yeah.
And then we're gonna be stuck with this guy. And so he asked me, he's like, would you want to play guitar? And I called him back. I was all, yeah, dude, but I'm just gonna tell you right now, I don't even have like real proper gear or anything. He's like, dude, it's okay, just we'll make it work. And he's like, he has this whole plan. I don't know if the guys even if they're listening to this. Like he was like, come over to my apartment like a week before we jam with the guys, with Aaron and Ben. And like, here's the plan. I'm going to like show you the parts that I have so far for the songs and like have you like, you know, help, we'll help you sort of make up some parts. And like, then when you come in, pretend it's the first time we've ever been in the room together. And the other guys are going to be so impressed that you like know how to play these parts so well, you know, that you put it out on your own. So we like totally made this total scheme just to like, because it was basically like either Tim gets his way and I get in the band, or Ben gets his way and his guy gets in the band. And so Tim like kind of like, we kind of like, we kind of fucked with it a little bit. And I was like, awesome, dude, I'll do it.
Fate, you know, right there.
I show up, I'm like, hey guys, wait, which one do you want to play first? And they're like, which one did you learn? I was like, I learned them all, man. You know, let's do them. You know? And they're like, okay. And they're, and I still kind of sucked, you know, but my gear was like, I had this like old shitty guitar that was like barely stayed in tune. And you know, so that alone was kind of a, this should have been a red flag. They should have got rid of me right then and there.
Yeah. Shouldn't be here today. Yeah.
It was like, dude, like somehow my limitations on guitar ended up being just what the band needed.
Yeah.
And in a really weird way, like for me, I was like, I couldn't play shredding parts if I tried. So like, I'm going to focus on playing like kind of catchy, simple, repetitive parts that I can like still play with while I'm rocking out on stage. Yeah. So I'm not like, you know, and so it was a really like immature attitude. It was like, I want to like be able to look cool, have my guitar slung really low, and be able to jump around on stage and still play my parts.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, I don't want to have to be like playing parts that you need like 3 feet to play on pedal boards and like, you know, years of training to play on guitar. And so if you listen to Sugar Hill, I'm telling you right now, it's not the most like, you know, musically sophisticated. Sure. You don't have to be a virtuoso to play our shit. But I think that is part of the appeal with our band, is that like, it's, I mean, to me, I think they're good songs. I think the songwriting is on point. But I think the parts are like economical enough that it's not just like, you know, it doesn't sound like something you couldn't figure out how to play on your own.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I think that a lot of people maybe could relate to it a little bit more. It
was absolutely.
A little more human.
I think it's a good thing for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. That was kind of how we started our band. And that was the model. It was just like, let's just fucking do this. But once I got in the room with those guys, I felt something I'd never felt before in any other band I'd been in. And that was like this like intense work ethic and like almost like it was almost like competition within the band. Like, who cares about this band more?
Yeah. You know?
Ben kind of won because he was like, well, dude, I live in our fucking practice space. I don't know about you. You know, he's like, I'm here fucking 20. By the time you guys get to practice, I've already been playing drums for fucking 4 hours and recorded last night's practice into a thing and like made, you know, like a demo out of it. And we're like, okay, fuck, you're pretty gnarly, dude. Yeah. You're crazy, you know? And Aaron was like, well, dude, by the time I was 9 years old, I was a fucking opera singer. So I'll just sit here and wait while you guys spend the rest of your life trying to catch up to my technique. You know, like he was like a child prodigy. So we were like, well, fuck. And then Tim and I were just like, you know, kind of figuring out how to play as we went. And so we weren't like governed by a bunch of rules. We didn't like know what you're allowed to do or not. It was mostly just like, does that sound cool? I think so. Is that cool? And then maybe we'd look at Aaron and be like, is this okay? Like, speaking? Cause like, I don't fucking know the difference between major or minor. Like, we didn't know shit. You know, we were just and Aaron was like, well, actually you could do it that way, but you could also do it this way. And then Ben, our drummer, was a really musically knowledgeable guy. He played multi-instrumentalist, and he would be like, I like what you're doing there, Marco, but imagine if you did it like a little bit like that and then tried that every once in a while. And I'd be like, oh shit, that's cool. So we all kind of helped each other, and we would have these marathon practices like 4 times a week where we would practice for like at least 4 hours and then take breaks, like record ourselves, sit around listening to it. And like, then go, like, it'd be like 2 a.m. and we'd have shit to do the next day. And we'd be like, well, what do you think, guys? Should we run it one more time? Or should we just maybe play that one song? And like most bands that I had played in were like, it was like, kind of like, well, we're good. You know, I want to try to make it for last call at the bar or whatever, you know? And for some reason, this band was like, one more time, let's run it fucking 2 more times. One time without vocals, one time with vocals. And I'd just be like, it's fucking 2 a.m. But I'm like, sure, you know? Yeah. Like I said, I had already verbalized, I remember confiding to my girlfriend at the time, I was like, I think I'm done playing music. Like, I think I've done this, and this is just like, I just got to fucking surrender and be like, yeah, it's just, I guess I tried.
Yeah.
I know I tried and it just didn't work out. And so here I am, like, and then when I met Tim and he asked me, I literally, even with that, I had still in my mind, I was done. And I was just like, well, this will be fun. This will just be fun to hang with this cool guy that I get along with and something to do. And like, at least I'm playing guitar, which is kind of fascinating. It's kind of like learning another language. Mm-hmm. So I was like, this will be cool. Just as like sort of a stopgap between now and whatever the rest of my life looks like. And then, you know, fucking next, you know, 10 years later, it was like, oh shit, I guess this is like what we do. Like,
yeah.
Honestly, like my mindset was totally like, this is just for now.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got in the room with those guys, I was like, holy shit, these guys fucking want this as much as, or maybe more than I do.
Yeah.
And I am not going to fuck with that. Like, I'm not going to like, this is amazing. This is like, let's just see when this thing, let's just go with it.
Yeah.
We just went and like every practice, every day, it was like, we like type out our fucking plan and like hang it up on the studio wall and be like, this is our goal. This is what we're trying to do. Take every show we could, you know, and like, it just started to work. And it was, and the other attitude was like, say yes to shit. Like we had like labels sort of interested in us, bigger labels, like they'd fly out from the East Coast and come see us play and like rent out the Viper Room and have us do a showcase. And then they'd be like, yeah, keep on sending us your demos, guys. You guys are pretty cool. We think we, you know, we're interested. Another label came along and they had nothing going for them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, we fucking love you guys. Will you sign to us? And we're just like, we better just do it. Like, if we don't make a move now, we're going to like lose momentum or we're going to like overthink this shit. So like we ended up signing with the first label that like offered us a deal.
Yeah.
And that was probably a little reckless, but in the end, it ended up being a wonderful.
Worked out.
Yeah. It worked out because they were like, in a weird way, like it wasn't like we were the little band trying to get signed to this big label. It was kind of like this sort of little label that didn't really have anything going for them. But they had money and they had the things we needed from a label. So like we sort of needed each other. It was mutual. Like they needed us as much as we needed them. And once we started working, you know, we did the Warped Tour and they ended up giving us the whole tour. So we were like, they saw how hard we were willing to work. And they were like, okay, fuck it. You guys want us to press up another batch of those? Yeah. You're out of samplers? We'll send you some more. And we're like, cool. And we're like, we will fucking work as hard as you let us work. Like, if you give us, and they gave us an $80 a night. I remember this, our first year of touring after the Warped Tour, we started just touring like as an opening band for people. Like,
I think you went with Less Than Jake, right? On one of those tours.
Right. I think we opened for Less Than Jake on the East Coast. For we opened for Goldfinger. We opened for Real Big Fish, opened for Good Charlotte. We opened for like, we just kind of got on any tour. Unwritten Law, like all these bands would take us on tour. We're just like, yes, yes, yes. But, you know, back then you're making like, if you're lucky, you're making like $200 to play the show, but you've got, you know, one or two people on the road with you, helping you with your gear, selling your merch. You've got maybe your van and, you know, the money gets spent really fast. Mm-hmm. So we needed what's called tour support, where our label was willing to give you some money to like offset the cost of your hotels or whatever. And they gave us $80. They budgeted for us like an $80 or maybe like two $80 hotel rooms a night. Mm-hmm. And so we literally would drive like a few hours out until we could find a place that was like the shittiest, like bargain brand version of a Days Inn or a Motel 6.
Yeah.
It was like $35 a night. You know, you'd find those hotels in the middle of nowhere.
Those Bates Motels ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And we would stay. We were like, dude, our budget, our label thinks our budget is $80 a night. Our budget's $40 a night. So we're like, because our attitude was like, we're going to tour for 2 years on the same amount of money that they're allotting for us to tour for 1 year. Mm-hmm. And we ended up, you know, I have pictures of this. Like you see like two of us in each bed and then one of us sleeping on the floor. Luckily, Aaron liked sleeping on the floor. Like, I don't know. He just didn't like the idea of all these different uneven shitty hotels. Probably smart. You know, he's the smartest guy. Like, he's like, I'll take my sleeping
bag on the
floor every night. You guys can probably get that like bed bug ridden, disgusting fucking, you know, like serial killer fucking bed. Plus you have your bro, like, you know, it's like a twin bed with like your singer, like sleeping, you know, you wake up with like Tim's leg on top of you.
Yeah.
Like breathing in your face, hot breathing, you know, so that was it for a while until we could like move up to the next notch, which was like one hotel room a night. Plus we had a slightly bigger vehicle that could sleep two people.
Right.
So we would feel like, okay, so we had like an RV, and then we did that for a while. And then we moved on to like, I remember we had Story of the Year when they were just mm-hmm. coming out. We had them as opening for us, and we like went in halvesies with them and shared the same crew and shared the same bus. So we had this yep. like bus with like two bands, you know, just like 20 people on this one bus. We're just on top of each other the whole time. And like, and then eventually we got to the point where we could have our own bus.
Yeah.
And that was like the most glorious thing in the world. We're like, holy shit, this is amazing. It's like, you know,
you've made it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like to me, that was like the ultimate, but you know, we literally toured, dude, I'm telling you, we toured like nonstop from like the Warped Tour 2001. I don't think we stopped touring until close to 2004. And that was like while we were making Palm Trees and Power Lines, mm-hmm. which came out in April of 2004.
Yeah.
This goes back to the spring.
Yeah.
And while we were recording that record, we still didn't stop touring. We would be recording that record, like the one that has Memory mm-hmm. and She's the Blade. And
yeah.
Back to California, all those songs. Like we would be jumping on planes and flying to England and flying to Japan to support Start Static, because Start Static got re-released by a label in Europe in 2003 and re-released by a label in Japan in 2008. So we were like a brand new band all over again.
Yeah.
Like we were kind of living this double life where we're like working on our second record, but at the same time going over to these foreign countries and like behaving like we were a brand new band with a brand. The good thing about that was we were able to sneak Memory into our set. Cause Memory is the first song we wrote for our second, for Palm Trees. And we were able to sneak it in our set, like right between Stuck in America and Daddy's Little Defect, we throw like Memory and the momentum wouldn't stop. Like the kids had never heard it before, but they were stoked on it. And that was a kind of a good way to sort of gauge, like, I think that should be our first single. People seem to like that song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and then we made Palm Trees. So Palms for the whole journey from like making Start Static to making and releasing Palm Trees was like one nonstop chapter of time. Like literally.
Absolutely.
You know, and then we didn't come
crazy
up for
time.
Air. Yeah. We didn't come up for air until 2005 when we took like spring of 2005, when we finally decided to like, take our time and make what would become Lights Out.
Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and stop there for this week. I've got part two coming up with Marco next week. Marco and I ended up talking for about 2 hours, so I decided to split this up and give you guys a bit of a break rather than had to force you to sit down and listen to 2 hours. I mean, I can't really force you to sit down and listen to this for 2 hours, but you get the point. So thank you guys so much for checking it out this week. I'm so excited for next week's episode to get part two. You guys can dive in with us as we talk a little bit more about Lights Out, and we talk a little bit about Van Wilder, how Sugar Cult got themselves on Van Wilder, how they got a music video with Tara Reid and Ryan Reynolds, and then even the future of Sugar Cult, if there's ever potential for a new record and everything like that. So we dive into all of that and more next week's episode. So thank you guys so much for checking it out this week, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.